Oh, that was really, really beautiful. Really, really beautiful. Well done, Bradfords. Good morning. Where, here I am. I notice they love it when you do that little guitar thing just before we start the beginning song. They love that. They love that. So welcome to the West Valley Center for Spiritual Living. I'm Reverend Karen Rice, and I can't remember if Clyde asked this, but is there anybody visiting for the first time? Let me see, show of hands. There are. Good. Welcome. It's nice to have you here. I feel like I'm a little loud. I'm trying to, like, you know, pull it down, and I'm going to get excited, so I don't want to hurt anybody too badly. Is that better? All right, good. Okay. Oh, here I am. Now I'm feeling it. Now I'm feeling it. So we have been talking all through the month of June about the CSL theme, Centers for Spiritual Living all over the world, have been focusing on this idea of accountability. It's a part of what Clyde was speaking to as the values-based spiritual living. And accountability is something that I have handled very gingerly all month. In fact, I even, as those of you who have been here each week know, I even made up my own definition, which I will remind you, the spiritual idea through the eyes of Reverend Karen for accountability is that it is a logical yet not punitive approach to participating in our own well-being. And I like that because it takes any possibility for guilt out of the equation. If we guilt ourselves, I think that we're putting an energy on the possibilities that then sort of lessen the grandness that Spirit intends for us to experience in our day-to-day living. So I thought I would close out the month with a message this morning that I have entitled All Day Long, because it is going to be sort of a summation of everything else we've talked about all month, but it is also setting us up for where we're headed in the month to come. Can you believe it's almost July? It's because I'm a little stunned by the whole movement of life so quickly. It seems to be gaining momentum and all of that. So what we think makes a difference. If you're new to this teaching, I would say the bottom line, easiest way to sum it up in a generalized way is that what you think makes a difference, that our thoughts are things. Our founder, Ernest Holmes, spoke about that with great consistency, and it really is sort of what we're all about. We often say, change your thinking, change your life, and that's a beautiful way to look at it. And so this morning, as I look back at all the things we've spoken about already this month, I want to remind you that what you think about your life all day long, what you think about your life all day long shapes how you see the world. And what you think about life in general shapes the way you move through your life and how you relate to everything else in the universe. And maybe even more personal and more specifically, I would say that what you think about yourself, what we think about ourselves all day long, really does shape who we are. Because we're always becoming. We're always becoming that next best expression of who and what we are and what we're to do and how we show up in relationship to each other and, of course, the planet and life. So the thought I had about the talk was that if we could take all the thoughts we have in any given day, everything we've thought about all day long in one 24-hour period, so I guess we'd have to throw our dreams in there too, wouldn't we, if we did 24 hours, what we were thinking about all day long, if you could put it in like a jar so you could see it, and you could shake it all up, what would it look like? What color would it be? What kind of vibration would it have? Because our thoughts create an energetic way that we are inside this beautiful physical body. So it's kind of an interesting thought. If we could take it all, another thought. Oh, throw that in the jar too. If we could take it all and see what it is that best defines or shows us what our life is like, we would see it there when we mixed it all together. Because the founder of this teaching, Dr. Ernest Holmes, believed that there is an atmosphere of thought that we create in the way that we have sort of a tendency to think in certain ways. So if I'm concerned about a problem in my life or an issue in the world, that creates then a tendency of thought that all my other thoughts are going to be influenced by. And then that's the way that shapes our attitude, which then shapes our beliefs and the way in which life always reflects to us back what we believe. So you could put all your thoughts in a jar and shake it all up, or you could just look at your life. Because your life is an outpicturing of everything you've thought about all day long, day after day, and there's this cumulative effect. And the beautiful part of what I'm here to tell you this morning is that I have great news for you. You have the power to change your mind. Yeah. So just in case you forgot that at any point between last week and this week and you needed that little reminder, there is a big amen attached to the way that we rejoice over that great, great and mighty truth, that we do have the power to change our mind. I do like to add to that idea of the thoughts that we have all day long. So the other thing that Dr. Ernest Holmes spoke about was that we are not only reflecting what we think by what shows up in our life, but we are also impacted by the thoughts of other people as well. And he called that the race consciousness. So you might say that there's us, and we've talked about this recently, especially in that talk on Pareto's principle. I did the 80-20 rule. So there's this way that we show up and we realize we have choice. How did I say it? The availability of the observability and the capability of, you know, the choices we make then give us the credibility, if we so desire, of the life we lived, the credibility in a way that is pleasing to us. But we are also impacted by what everybody else thinks. And I think that's part of what goes sideways in the world when we watch news and whatnot. I read somebody on Facebook said last week, this is how my day began, something like this. I haven't even had that first cup of coffee yet, and something on the news has me so stirred up my coffee doesn't even taste good anymore. Well, what's wrong with that comment? You know, if you're me and a minister, and I talk about this all the time, what's wrong with that is that I don't look at the news before I have that first cup of coffee and make a decision as to what I'm going to think about my day and how I want to show up about the day. I claim my good before I get anywhere near what's going on in the outside world. I mean, it's enough that we have families that we have to contend with and throw into that, but then there's that other greater equation. And so that's what Holmes means when he's talking about the race consciousness that can impact us. And as I pointed out a couple weeks ago, that we are, Holmes always said, if just saying your prayer in the morning, just blessing the day in the morning now helps you to rise, remembering God, remembering there's a presence and a power greater than we are, helps you to rise above 51%. So you're sort of getting above that consciousness that for me, it always feels like it's just a cloud that's out there. And I can walk around in that cloud, or I can choose the thoughts I have before I step into the outer world, and that then boosts me up. Now, I would say my theory is, and is the blog out yet, Christine? Did we post the blog yet? I just wrote a blog that'll be posted soon. And it's about the 80-20 rule. And my opinion is that if we choose to be have a spiritual practice and be prayed up and come get inspired on a Sunday morning or whatever you do, that read things that are nourishing instead of scary or distracting, when we do that, we not only rise above 51% of the population, I think that then puts us in that 20% of the population. It's probably even less than that. But let's just say, because Pareto's principle is a generalization, and that means that we are then looking through a perspective that is higher than 80% of the population. And I wished Ernest Holmes was here so I could have this debate with him, because I think it's better than 51%. I think it rises us even higher and gives us a greater way of relating to everything that's going on. So by right of consciousness, by the way we know that in God all things are possible, or the way we say all things work out for good, for the highest and the best for all involved, or in my favorite way lately, the way Emma Curtis Hopkins says it, there is a good for me and all I ought to have it. Well, that was fun. Let's do it one more time. There is a good for me and I ought to have it. So in that way, we are practicing what Ernest Holmes would call right thinking. Right meaning proper, not politically right or left. Just wanted to clear that up. And so, I know, phew, right? And so as we are always participating in creating our good, whether we're conscious of that or not, our good or our lack of good, we do influence by the way we choose to think and use our thoughts all day long. So when we're active and are choosing our right thoughts, Holmes says that we really are using what is called an active form of right thinking. But he goes on to say this, and I love this. This is why I love coming up here every Sunday. I can tell you these little tidbits that we rejoice as we recall again. He said, even our lifelong habits of wrong thinking, which might be on the negative side of, if you're looking at right and wrong in terms of thinking, even our lifelong habits of wrong thinking can be consciously and deliberately neutralized. And so we know that happens in the instant we have a different thought. The instant we change our thinking, we've initiated an inner change that is then going to reflect in our outer world. And I rejoice in that. So a quote I saw this week that's so refreshing. In the world through which I travel, I am endlessly creating myself. Franz Fanon, I looked it up, but it didn't impress me. Apparently not worth repeating to you because I didn't write it down. In the world through which I travel, I am endlessly creating myself. And that sums it up. That says it really quite beautifully. So I don't think it's any surprise to us, if I say this out loud, I don't think anybody will even shudder, but the world has changed a lot in the last 100 years or so. And Ernest Holmes has been, it looks like we're going to be celebrating 100 years of the science of mind next year. And so I know that he published his first book in 1919, actually. But we're looking as an organization that has evolved now for about 100 years. And I would say that a lot of things have changed in that 100 years. We seem to know that on some level. It's so evident on all levels, actually. And so Holmes said this, I wanted to commend his vision, because this for me is like another piece. Whoever becomes receptive to the idea of peace, poise, and calm, think of the changes in the last 100 years. Whoever becomes receptive to the idea of peace, poise, and calm, whoever embodies these divine realities, finds them flowing through him or herself, and that person then becomes peaceful, poised, and calm. So this morning, I will say we have talked about our ability to notice what we're thinking. If your thinking doesn't suit you, then stop it. We talked about that not that long ago. And the third point is to think better thoughts. These are really the first four steps of Emma Curtis Hopkins' lessons, now that I think about it. And then the fourth lesson is to be, he's saying, be receptive, be open. How do we invite in the peace and the poise and the calm? What he's saying is it's not enough to just think it, But how do we then, you know, open ourselves to sort of take it all in? And that's where we get to play in a very personal way, including how much we're able to embody in terms of peace and calm and poise, and then we could extend that out to beauty and joy and harmony and all the other divine qualities that we speak about here. I do not think there has been a better time for our message on this planet than today. And at the same time, I'm certain that has been true for every generation that preceded the times we're living in now. That has to be true. If you think that Ernest Holmes published that first book in 1919, and this movement just continued to grow through all of those years, well, look at what was happening in the world from that time period on. And that's sort of what I want us to look at. We're living in this great time of change, and so I think my challenge today is very specifically about how we individually, because we're individualized expressions of the divine, how do we individually desire to think about all the changes that are ongoing in the world? And so what has interested me lately is to look at the different generations, and I find it intriguing that we name generations. We haven't always done that. But, you know, before the turn of into the 20th century, so the last 20 years of the 1800s, that was the first generation that was ever named. Anybody know who actually is responsible for naming it? Or what it is? What it was called? Nope. Who said that? Was that my beloved? Oh, that's so cute. Look, he's playing. I love that. My heart is so happy. That was fun. The first generation was actually the it had its own name. Ironically, it's the lost generation, and I lost it. Couldn't find it there anywhere. How real is life? And it was called the Lost Generation because the people that were born between 1880 and 1900, by the way, Ernest Holmes was born in that time period. He was born in 1887. They were considered the Lost Generation because when they came of age, they headed off to the First World War, and there was a huge change in the world after that experience. Which is interesting to me because the Civil War wasn't that many years before the First World War. So if you start looking at the historical context of all of this, it becomes really sort of juicy. Now, I want you to listen up over here, you youngsters, because we're going to be getting, well, not yet, but in about 5 minutes. Nudge him in about 5 minutes. It's going to get interesting for you because I'm going to be talking about you. See if you can figure out, you can find your place in all of this too. The reason we began naming generations, I think, is valuable because what we see is there's a cultural dynamic in the shift of every generation. So it was actually Gertrude Stein that coined the term the lost generation. And it might not have gone anywhere except Ernest Hemingway picked it up, and he used it in the same context that she did in his book, The Sun Also Rises. And from there on, they began to make a reference to that particular generation in terms of the way they had sort of were disillusioned, the way they had lost hope for a world and the way that they desired to experience their life in the world. So if I look at the way I have seen the world change in my life, and I'm a baby boomer, how many of you know that you're a boomer? Raise your hand if you know you're a boomer. Okay, Very good. It's funny because the boomers are taking over Sun City. And it must be confusing for the people that are older than the boomers because they still like rock and roll. And so that has to be, as I look at some of those big gatherings they do, where, you know, some of us still like Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix. It's got to be real confusing for those in their 80s and 90s that are not, you know, that predate the boomers. But at any rate, if I look at my own life, there's a good illustration here that most of you will be able to relate to. You, not so much. But this will be interesting to you. This should be entertaining to you. So something happened in the, you know, I remember being a little girl, and our TV was a box. And I don't really know how tall it was because I was a little girl. It seemed huge to me. But I'm going to guess it was about this tall, but the TV screen was only about this big. So maybe that's not shocking because you guys watch TV on your tablets probably and are accustomed to that. But that was like big stuff. We were excited to have radio, but then we had TV, and many people here. Raise your hand if you remember getting your first TV, if you remember life before TV. Look around the room. That's interesting. That's fascinating. So I remember getting a TV, but then my husband and I had children, and then there came a time in probably the 80s where we had our first VCR, and that was thrilling because now we had some control. If we were going to be gone somewhere, we could record a TV show and not have to miss it if we had to sit in church or something and there was something wonderful we wanted to watch on TV. The only problem was we couldn't figure out how to work them. So we needed our children to program the VCR for us, right? And that is, I mean, we laugh at that, but we relate to that. We understand that. And then the world changed again, and computers became more and more common. And so one of my memories is that I was sitting, showing my mom my new computer. It may have actually been my first computer, but I'm not sure my first computer had a mouse. So I'm showing my mom how the mouse works on the computer. It's going to make you laugh. And so my mom is sitting right here, and we're laughing so hard because she's moving the mouse around, but she cannot get it to the right place or figure out how to click on whatever little game or recipe, whatever I was showing her. But at the same time that I was showing my mom, I'm holding one of my grandbabies on my lap, a child that was a mere year old, who was totally comfortable with not only sitting in front of the computer monitor, but was able to take the mouse and maneuver it to the object on the screens that my mom couldn't even come close to. And so, and then it became a game. We would point, make it go here, Matthew. And he would make it go right to your finger. You could move it around, and it was as if he was born with an instinct for it, because I think they were. Because I think every generation comes with different skills prepared for the world that they are entering. And so it is no, and by the way, that youngster is 17 now, and he is quite a wizard. He's brilliant and will probably make a fine career out of his ability to move the mouse at, you know, 12 months old. So I think we can say, even if we just looked at the way our children helped us program the VCR, and the way that, my kids are Gen X, I'm a baby boomer, they're Gen X, the way that they depend on their kids for their smartphones, for stuff in their smartphones that they may not, although that generation, Gen X is pretty savvy too, technologically speaking. But you can see that it continues to change as the world continues to change. Now, the reason this is relevant is because the millennial generation, which everyone is looking at right now, where everybody's got their eyes on the millennial generation, I'll talk to you about why in a minute, but they are becoming a really wonderful field of study because it seems as though they are inheriting a world with a very different culture than any of us have yet to experience. And they seem, I want you to have an open mind here as I say this, it is appearing to me, the more that I study this, that they are coming with the skills to manage the change that the world is moving through. It's just a possibility. But I'm convinced that there's something really relevant here. So what we see is as we look at the generations of the world and how we name them and how they continue to change, there's a certain way that each generation shares certain characteristics. And that's what I want to look at, because we are talking today about what do you think all day long. So my hunch is that this generation thinks different thoughts than this generation. And the two generations in between those also have a different way they think. I love the reading, and I love that song, that thought. I mean, dun, 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 how did you, what you think, how did, oh, there's such a, yeah. So there's a think line in there that I, so I think to myself. It's like you were singing that song, and I thought, man, I never heard that in the context of the way I'm thinking about thinking at this moment. And so what do you think to yourself about? Now, it's easy to throw all the certain generation in a box and label them, and that's how some of these names got started. Let me give you a really good example. After the Lost Generation, the next 20 years, 1900 to about 1920, the early 1920s, was called the GI Generation, right? Both World War I and World War II, they saw as they came of age. And then the next generation after that, you may or may not realize this, but originally they were referred to as the Silent Generation. Those are the ones who were born between the 1920s, but all the way up to 1946. This is the generation that preceded the baby boomers. This is the generation that gave birth to us, those of us who are baby boomers. And they were called the Silent Generation at first because they were the first generation where there was such an emphasis on children are to be seen and not heard. They were the first generation that were, there was a strong emphasis on conforming to social norms. They were a good house, a good family would have a stay-at-home mom. Right? So what was good about this generation was that they were on the other side of the last World War. When they came of age, they were on the other side of that. So what happened was, and the reason they created the baby boomers was because all the military personnel came home from war, and the world had changed so. And the GI grant, the GI Bill became available to veterans, and they were encouraged to buy these tract homes that were designed around cities, and that's when the suburbs were born. A different kind of thinking. Think of city life as opposed to suburb living. With different way of thinking all day long. Now, it wasn't long before Tom Brokaw showed up on the scene and said, let's not be the silent generation. Let's be the greatest. He proclaimed that that generation was the greatest generation because of the way in which they had lived through the Great Depression and they had fought in the war, and they went on to build what Tom Brokaw considered the modern America. And we like that. Don't we like that term better than the silent generation? But it was Time magazine that labeled that the silent generation. These titles often came out of the literary realm, the journalists. And it had to do with the way they were, they said that the Time magazine article said that they didn't protest, they just did what they had to do, they conformed as they needed to conform. But it's also apparent that the McCarthy era probably impacted some of that idea of being silent so that you could stay out of trouble. And then Brokaw changes it to the greatest generation, and then voila, massive new generation that is a bit idealistic. The Washington Post is credited with naming the baby boomers baby boomers. And this is a time where not only did the GI Bill help people have homes they could live in and own, but then product for consumers was just, there was more money to spend and there was more product created. There was great variety. And And what happened was that we baby boomers produced the smallest generation, the Gen X, is the smallest generation in terms of numbers, sandwiched between this massive millennial, the millennials, and the baby boomers. And part of that was the access to birth control and all of that. But now these Gen Xers, these are my children. They were born between, and many of your children, they were born between 65 and roughly 1980. And they came out different. They still are sometimes, in all the research I did, they're referred to as a bit cynical. They weren't as idealistic as their parents were. Think of the hippies, and then now they go, oh, thanks a lot, look at the world you gave us, you know. They're pragmatic, they're called slackers, and here are the two reasons they credit the sort of the derogatory terminology was, one, they were latchkey kids. They were the only latchkey generation. And they're also considered the MTV generation. So sort of the beginning of, you know, the beginning of technology and access to broader worlds than maybe the mom and dad would let you have. But women had gone to work, and there were a high number of kids that were latchkey kids. So what's interesting is, though we still have our opinions, what you think influences the greater whole. So notice what you're thinking about all of this, but that this generation that was once called slackers is turning out to be the greatest number of entrepreneurial contributors. They're not only effective in the way that they show up in life, but they seem, according to researchers, they say they are the first generation to have found a healthy balance. Some of this is stunning for even me. A healthy balance between their work life and their personal life. And I'd have to say that does in many ways describe my own kids. And by the way, because they were latchkey kids, they're more peer-oriented than former generations. I know that's a little odd. I remember growing up in the boomer days where you played with all the neighborhood kids, but they're talking about a different kind of relationship. And it was the Gen X kids that have now given birth to the millennial generation. Now everything is completely different. It's almost as though that Gen X was that turning point, was a big turning point. I stand back and I look at it. Here's the way we describe the millennial generation. Not quite to you yet. No? Not quite to them yet. Though I do notice every time I do research, they change the dates. So they include younger and younger. And in part, I would say that I notice that my Gen X kids have many of these characteristics that the millennials do as well. So see what you notice. Notice what you think as I read this list of what describes the millennial generation. They are, and this is kind of a new term, they are the first digital natives. They do not know a world before computers, before gadgets, before smartphones, before their tablets and all of those things. They weren't born into all those things, but they are of age as those things have come into their life. They have a high regard for diversity and inclusivity. Sound familiar? That's what we teach. That's what we encourage. That's what we have talked about for 100 years. And now it's trendy because of the millennials. the thing that's markedly different about them is they do not have the money that other generations have had. So they spend their money differently, and I think that's in part why there's so much research on them. Marketers want to know, what do we do to capture this group? So the millennial generation are typically in their 30s. They were born from 1980 to 2000, and again, this is a generalization. They change. It depends on whose work you're reading. But I would say the fact that they don't have a lot of money is why we're seeing a trend toward minimalism. Simplifying, because that's their world. And the other thing is, they don't have the same need for ownership like we who are older than they are. They don't need to buy a home. They don't even need to buy a car. They actually are starting car sharing. I'm not talking about carpooling. I'm talking about finding a buddy to buy a car with, because we don't need to have our own car. They have a whole different consciousness. That wouldn't work for me, right? But it's not only working for them, but they are predicting that by 2030, car sharing will be the norm. We want to keep an eye on not only what's happening, but what are our thoughts around these things. The thing that's beautiful about them is they have, in addition to some other things, they have a high interest in their own well-being. So they are into exercise. They're into eating well. They're into really taking care of themselves in sort of a holistic, well-rounded way. And that is where they are spending their money. They don't have any problem spending money on things that have to do with their fitness or their well-being. This has changed in the last couple of years because I just found some brand new research that's very credible and just recently published. In terms of social media, even a couple years ago, they were saying that the baby boomers were the biggest presence on Facebook, but we now realize that even though the millennials love all the other, you know, Instagram and tweeting and all the ones I probably haven't even heard of yet, they use Facebook the most. And they are not, they do not consider themselves to be social activists, but they are certainly drawn to the political causes that matter to them. And they will take a stand and publicly post something on Facebook, but listen very carefully to this. This is stunning information. They will not do it in a way that puts down another person. They will post where they stand on an issue, and maybe it's even a hot issue, but they are not angry about it, they are not loud about it, and they will not do that in such a way that is disrespectful. So we're not talking about everybody. There's always exceptions, but generally speaking, these are this is the newest data. This is what we know, that there is a shift in their consciousness that cannot be explained any other way than the Karen theory, and that is they're just coming to the planet differently. And of course, every generation will then want to do things differently than the way they're, you know, we want to be different than our parents and so on and so forth. So there's a bit of a swing, the evolving that we can measure in terms of their interest in the future of the world is not as dramatic as some of us who are older. So maybe they're more adaptable to change, and that would be a good thing because they're going to have to be. So, and the other thing is they're very service-oriented, and they're very interested in meaning and purpose. So, yes, they're less interested in organized religion because they don't want to be told what to do, and they can't bear the idea of, you know, this is the only faith and everybody else is wrong. That's too exclusive. And so that's, again, why I see this beautiful teaching that we have that doesn't ever do that. We honor all paths, and we understand that there are lots of ways to move through life and have a spiritual experience. Oh, and by the way, this is where, do you know what your generation is going to be called? No, Dad. Be careful what you think. All day long. Gen Z is how it started, but it's looking like they're going to call you the founders. They're going to be called the founders. That seems to be the big lean that is being said again and again, and that is because based on the idea of finding a new way so that you can make sense of the world in a way that we couldn't. You guys are born and here on the planet to bring us the changes that we need to do right now. And it is expected that the founders will follow in the footsteps of the millennials. I don't see why not. It seems like every generation has gotten more and more, according to this data. And because there is a continued desire to mend what we call the social disruption in life. So there you go. That's it. You're a founder. Yeah, you found it. Yay. The trend in how we think about life. This is just a really good illustration that we go through all these titles and the names of the different generations and the expectations. And then we look back after they've grown. So now the millennials are in their 30s and we're watching what they're doing and watching how they're fitting in with the changes that are happening in the world. These things are important because it shows me that there is a greater consciousness than the individual consciousness. There is a greater consciousness than that race consciousness that Ernest Holmes was speaking about. And it is that in which I believe we as what I'm going to call the 20% are growing together in affirming and knowing. It is that stuff that is about a world that works for everyone. Here's what Ernest Holmes said about it. It's very interesting because we didn't use that term, a world that works for everyone yet. Holmes said this: every business, every place, every person, everything has a certain mental atmosphere of its own. And this atmosphere decides what is to be drawn to it. There's a consciousness of a group. We have a consciousness as a community, and our consciousness is a little bit different than the Baptist church down the street. And that's, you know, there's beauty in diversity. There's no single right way to do this. But I wanted to remind us all that what we think about all day long, how we think about what's going on in the world, how we think about the different generations and the future generations, that our thoughts contribute to that greater whole, that bigger consensus. And so we are always, with every thought we have, creating an impact on that next generation, on that possibility of moving closer and closer to a world that works for all. So when we stand back, when we look at research like that, whether you agree with it or you don't, or it stirs you to want to go home and do your own research, which would delight me, what happens is we are taking a step back so that we can get a broader view, so that we can step out of our old ideas and our old beliefs, because this is what we know. Your brain is a magnificent thing, but what you believe is what you feed your brain, and your brain then will go out on any given day and try and validate for you what you believe. It's the function of the brain. It's the way the brain works. So look carefully at your beliefs. Notice your thoughts. Be accountable in that way that is not punitive, that is not judgmental, that does not make you be hard on yourself, but in a way that is uplifting, in a way that is broadening all the things that are possible. And I'm just grateful that we are here at this time, because I do believe with my whole heart that our teaching is indeed more relevant than it has ever, ever been before. So let's sit with this for just a moment, take a deep breath, and I would like to anchor some of these ideas in the words of prayer. Through all of time, for all the time that is yet to come, there is one mind, a It is the mind of God. And I know that that mind is my mind right now. It is the mind of each person sitting in a chair. It is that activity of life in every living being. It is the intelligence of all the universe. I know that it is God. It is infinite wisdom and perfect harmony. It is the way one thing fits together with the next thing. And I know that that power and that presence is right here, right now, in this very room. I feel the love of God pulsing in my physical body. And I know that it is the same heartbeat of life in every person sitting in this room or at the sound of my voice, that there is that same insistence of life that is ever expanding. It matters not what generation we were born into. It matters only what we choose to think day by day. Moment by moment, all day long, every day, after the next, we have this glorious gift of choice, of being conscious, of being awake and being aware. So in this moment where we can feel that activity of life stirring everywhere, I simply know that we have aligned ourselves to that perfect pattern of life. That it is a vibration that is healing, that it restores us to a sense of wholeness and connection to everyone and everything, and to that exquisite experience of communion with the divine. And so I know this is the way that every ailment that impacts our body in any way, any discouraging thought that touches our mind, that we are healed in the very moment that we remember a greater truth. And that it is this right thinking that neutralizes everything unlike it. And so I proclaim this day that the way in which we choose to think all day long creates that tendency of thought that is the beautiful potential for the healing of this planet, for the healing of our own lives, for the forgiveness of the problems that have unfolded in our relationships, so that we might reunite at a higher level, that we might rise above 80% of the everyday average thinking, that we might know and experience truth and love and health and prosperity and well-being in every way in our lives. And as this is true for us and as individuals, it must be true for those people that we love as well. And so I say thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, life. Thank you, Infinite Spirit. For we are renewed this day. We are inspired yet again to know how we are called, what we are to say, where we are to go, and how we can think. And it is in this spirit of deep appreciation that I just release the words of this prayer into that divine law that always responds affirmatively. And together we say, and so it is.